All right, so this morning I'm going to make a few more comments about the sixth trumpet, the sixth bowl that we looked at last week, and then we'll move on to the seventh and the final bowl judgment. If there's time, I'll introduce chapter 17, which along with chapter 18 are going to take us into a lengthy episode describing the demise and the ultimate fall of Babylon the Great. And you know what we've seen throughout Revelation is that for the believer, the great challenge of this life is that we must exist and we must function within a world system that is entirely inclined to the opposition of God and his people. And we saw that this world system is empowered by Satan. And it's one that really has as its chief focus the destruction of God's people. And we saw this reality pictured way back in chapter 12 as, you know, we see the dragon, you know, pursuing the woman into the wilderness with the hopes of destroying the man-child, Christ. And as the dragon realizes that he cannot defeat Christ, in fact, that his defeat is going to be at the hand of Christ, he turns his anger towards what is described as the woman's other offspring, his people, the church. And so this anger that the dragon has, that Satan has for God's people, has been manifested in large part through this world system that Revelation describes as Babylon the Great. So we'll see if we get to any of that this morning. But let me start by reading the text of the sixth and seventh bowls, beginning in verse 12 of chapter 16. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth and of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet three unclean spirits like frogs, for they are demonic spirits performing signs, who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake, keeping his garments on, that he may not go about naked and be seen exposed. And they assembled them at the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a great earthquake, such as there had never been since man was on the earth. So great was that earthquake. The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and God remembered Babylon the Great, to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. And every island fled away, and no mountains were to be found, and great hailstones, about 100 pounds each, fell from heaven on people, and they cursed God for the plague of the hail, because the plague was so severe. One of the striking things in studying Revelation, I think it becomes more apparent than probably anywhere else in Scripture, is just how great the diversity is amongst people and how they understand the text of Scriptures. And you know, we see this in the sixth seal in what's generally just referred to as Armageddon, as the event. And we talked about this at length, you know, last week, and just by way of reminder, I think that the all too common view is that, you know, one day in the future, you know, powerful armies are going to gather in Israel for this last great battle, you know, that leads to the end of life as we know it. And, you know, remember that in the dispensational, you know, view of this event, Armageddon, the church is not involved, because the church supposedly has already been removed from the earth even before the return of Christ in what they describe as a secret rapture. But also remember that in the dispensational view, so this shouldn't surprise us, because much of the book of Revelation, according to that view, has nothing to do with the church because they've been removed from the picture. And it's only relevant to Jews who would be converted or others who are converted, you know, during this time that they describe as the, you know, the Great Tribulation after the rapture. And, you know, I think by now you recognize that I reject pretty much every part of that common, you know, scheme. But there are many variations of descriptions out there. And I spent some time yesterday just Googling Armageddon, just to see, you know, where people's heads are at with what they think this looks like. So I'm probably on a Homeland Security watch list for, you know, I probably can't fly next time I go to the airport. But anyway, as you can imagine, there's all kinds of thoughts out there, more so than I even realized. And, you know, I did find a few websites where they start to describe it, and I think, you know what, they're really on the right track. They're capturing what the scripture really says. But even in those, at the end, they always seem to default back to this idea of actual historic nations, whether it be Russia, China, Japan. You know, there's a three of the countries from the East, you know, that are so often described. And they always seem to come back to this idea of a 200 million man army and all of this. And I really think that, by and large, all of that misses the point that we see in this sixth trumpet. I believe that what we're looking at is a climactic picture for sure, but it's a climactic picture of the spiritual warfare that has existed from the beginning, but has greatly intensified, specifically since the first advent of Christ in the first century. And remember the point I made last week that when you really look at the text of this trumpet, Armageddon is not pictured as a battle. Now, it says that these nations are gathered for battle, but there is no description of an ensuing battle or a war. There's no suggestion of an actual fight that takes place between sides. Armageddon is a gathering event. That's a key element of this. Because what's about to take place is not a war, but a judgment. They're being gathered for judgment. And that's a very different picture. And so there's just three key things that I want to review in the sixth bowl. And then we'll move on to the sixth bowl. I keep getting my bowls and trumpets mixed up.
The sixth.
What's that?
You threw seals in there too, but that's okay.
Well, you know what? When I was reviewing my notes this morning, I realized that in about 50% of my references, I had seal. I had to go back through and change seal to bowl every time. So it's all confusing. But I want to look at three things specifically. Three points. I think each one tells us something important about this passage. The first is has to do with the drying up of the Euphrates that we looked at last week, making way for the kings from the east. The second point is the idea that these nations are assembled for battle by demonic spirits. And then the third point is that they're assembled on what is described as, you know, the great day of God the Almighty. Okay, because that tells us something very specific about the purpose for which they gather. And, you know, we talked about the Old Testament event last week of Cyrus the Persian, the prince of the east, as he's described, who historically diverted the waters of the Euphrates, dried up the Euphrates so that he could defeat Babylon, the actual historic Babylon, and rescue the Jews from 70 years of captivity. He then went on to help them rebuild the temple and restore temple worship and all of this. So he was a great advocate for God's people. And this really, this Old Testament event, sets the context for all of this that we're reading about now. Because as I said, Cyrus, you know, in the Old Testament is a picture of both an agent of judgment. He defeated Babylon. He was God's instrument of judgment against Babylon. But at the same time, he was a rescuer of God's people from captivity. So both of these things describe, you know, Cyrus and what he did. And the text of the sixth bowl begins with just that. It begins with a promise of rescue and a promise of comfort. And this, of course, is where, you know, the views just diverge, you know, 180 degrees. Because, you know, when many start seeing drying up the Euphrates and the kings from the east, they're lumping all of this in with the battle of Armageddon. Whereas I think we understand from the Old Testament that this is an image of you know, what I believe is that God's people will be rescued from this thing that we call Babylon the Great, just as he rescued his people from Babylon of old. And that brings up the question, you know, who do I believe that the kings of the East will be? And this is just my opinion, but I really believe that it can be nothing other than Christ himself. Will be our rescuer in this climactic end, you know, to the battle of good and evil. And if you think about this, who else could it be? Who else on earth could rescue God's people from this vast, you know, world system that has opposed God and opposed his people? Because this is not a situation like Babylon of old, where you have a geographically defined kingdom of Babylon, and you have a specific group of people who have been taken captivity. Babylon the Great is universal. It covers all the nations of the earth and all the peoples of the world. There's not a situation where there's going to be godly nations that rescue all of the believers of the world from the clutches of Babylon. And, you know, and some have talked about things like, well, there's going to be an alliance between the United States and Israel, and they will rescue, you know. I really think that's off in left field, because as much as we love our country, we're patriotic, we do recognize that you know, our country abandoned, you know, its value of Christianity, its defense of Christianity long ago. And, you know, and Israel continues to deny, you know, the God of scriptures. You know, as I've said, you know, many times, they're not a picture of a people that are just on the verge of Christianity. In some respects, you know, we could say that in Israel, we find the worst form of false religion practiced, in that God himself has come and revealed himself, and they reject that. So I say that just to say that there are no nations that are going to rescue, you know, God's elect from the clutches of Babylon. I think that only Christ himself can do such a thing. And this jumps ahead to point three, you know, that this is not going to be a battle, but rather it's going to be a great day of God the Almighty. And I'll come back to this. But the second point is that the nations, all of the nations, you know, we read here, the kings of the earth, an inclusive statement, will be gathered for this day. And I think it's no small detail given to us that the unclean spirits, the demonic spirits, you know, that come out of the mouths of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, these are the agents who are said to do the gathering. What's going to bring all these nations together? Well, we read here that it are these demonic spirits that are going to gather the kings of the earth together for battle. And there's a lot to think about in this picture, because deception is the way that Satan has maintained his hold on the nations forever. It's deception is the way that Satan has kept Babylon the Great so strong and so dangerous. It's deception that helps Babylon maintain its grip on the nations. And so this is really, when you think about this history of deception of the world, this is the final and the most ironic of deceptions, as the powers of the world are going to be convinced that they can gather together and that they can wage war and be victorious over Christ and over his people. This is why they think they're gathering. And again, I'm not talking about, you know, physically rolling into a specific geographic area, but there's going to come a day when the nations of the world will unite in a single purpose, and that is to defeat Christ and his people. And of course, this is deception, because Satan himself knows that this is not possible. We already read, you know, the account where Satan realizes that he cannot defeat the man-child. And in fact, this is what is the source of his anger and his rage towards Christ, is that he will not be victorious. And we're told that that's the reason he turned his attention to God's people. So the gathering together, they do so believing that it's to be for battle. But the reality is that ultimately God has orchestrated this gathering for the purpose of judging the nations who have allied themselves with Babylon the Great. And this leads us to point three. You know, point two is you know, that Satan will be... This is actually a picture of Satan's betrayal of those who have been loyal to him through human history. The nations have been loyal to Satan. They've been loyal to the dragon. They've been loyal to Babylon. And now this is their great betrayal as they're lured into this, you know, this place, which is described for us, again, not as an actual battle, but it's described as the great day of God the Almighty. There's no battle to wage. You know, they assemble, as I said, to be judged as the system of this world, and they will be crushed once and for all. And, you know, there's so much talk in end times prophecy about a one world government. And all kinds of speculation. If you remember, you know, the formation of the European Union, and how many people said, well, this is it. This is, you know, the scriptures, you know, coming to pass and all of that sort of thing. And I had a crazy discussion this week with a patient that I probably shouldn't have had, but you know, usually I let these things go because nothing good usually comes out of it. But he just, you know, he started by telling me, we were talking about the election and all of that, and he started to tell me that Obama is building, President Obama is building a one world government, but we shouldn't be surprised because the Bible has predicted everything that President Obama has done during his presidency, which is absurd no matter how much you dislike President Obama. It's patently absurd. And so, I, you know, knowing he really is pretty ignorant of Scripture, and I know this guy well, he's a sweet guy, and he's a well-meaning Christian. He's a sincere Christian, but there is a certain level of ignorance there, because he went on to tell me that on September 30th, which is 5 days from now, that he just learned that the U.S. monetary system is going to be backed by something different. I'm thinking that's probably big news. I mean, I think that would shake up the world, and it's only 5 days from now, and nobody's heard of it. But he saw it on TV. He saw a teacher on TV. I asked him if he would still believe that teacher when September 30th comes and goes, and it doesn't happen. He also told me that there's a YouTube video I can go to, and he's in his 80s. I didn't even know that people in their 80s looked at YouTube. But he said there's a YouTube video that I can go to that will actually show the insertion of a chip into the hand, which will be the mark of the beast. And so I just asked him, I should let it go, but I asked him, well, what will the mark of God that's spoken of in the same passage, what will that look like? Do we get different chips and all that? He just looked at me like, are you crazy? But anyway, you know, like I said, I generally let that stuff go, but something that I said to him, and I truly regretted it afterwards, and even my nurse who was listening to this conversation said, you should have let this go. I told him that there's already been a one-world government for thousands of years. And that just did not compute to him. And of course, I was obligated to explain it, which is why I shouldn't have gone there. You know, because I explained that this idea of a one-world government, there actually is something to that. But it's not about politics. It's not about treaties and alliances amongst nations. The nations of the world have been in a spiritual alliance with Satan against God from the very beginning. So there has been a one world government in existence. And we see this expressed in history over and over again. We've seen nations that try to break away from that. But the history is they fail. I mean, we've even seen an example of a nation that tried to establish itself as a distinctively reformed nation. you know, with Kuiper as its prime minister, you know, a reformed man, and it just did not work. So we see it today, though. We see the manifestation of this in the West. We see this march towards the secularization of everything, you know, especially in places like France and in England. They just want to extinguish not just God from the public square, but anything that represents, you know, Christianity or religion in general. They don't discriminate. You know, they don't want to see the emblems of Muslim in their society either. It's a complete secularization, you know, that we see happening. The affections and the values of the nations are just not godly. And unfortunately, this includes the U.S. You know, having God on our money does not separate us or distinguish us from these other nations. You know, we too have pushed God out of public life, as has every other nation on earth. So yes, there is a one world alliance in place, but it's been in place for a very long time, and it's a spiritual alliance. And frankly, Revelation has no comment on actual political alliances, contrary to what we're told over and over again. Revelation doesn't really talk about specific nations. You know, my patient wanted at this point no part of you know, this discussion, and so he ended the conversation by saying, "Well, it really doesn't matter anyways, because we're going to be raptured any day."
So there.
I let him have the last word. I said nothing else. But these discussions go on over and over again, not just in my crazy office, but, you know, these are conversations we have with our friends and our family, and it's just really a shame how distracted we've become with the whole prophecy obsession. But anyway, those are the last comments that I want to make about the sixth bowl. We talked about that quite a bit last week. Any questions or comments on that before we move on? Yes.
If, I was wondering if you could say about the kings, if it was talking about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
The kings from the East?
Yes.
The kings from the East, we talked about, I realize you weren't here last week, but we talked about the history of that expression from the Old Testament, which represents, you know, I think the primary representation is Cyrus, and as he's described as a prince from the East who rescues God's people from Babylon. But we see that pattern over and over again in Israel's history, where God uses nations from generally their East for his purposes, to rescue his people, to judge those who oppose his people. So my point was that when we see that expression, the kings from the East, for a Jewish reader in the first century, that meant something. You know, that immediately made them think of God's rescuing. That's why I say for them, it's a promise of comfort and hope. When they hear kings from the East, that says God is going to do for us what he did before. You know, once again, he will do that. So I think that's the Old Testament background of that expression. So as we go into the seventh bowl, and as we've hopefully seen so far, each one of these cycles of judgment, the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, bring us closer and closer to the end in terms of the focus on final judgment. You know, we saw the preliminary aspect of final judgment in the seals and the trumpets, but the sixth and seventh bowls bring us right to the end. You know, as the world system is judged. Yes.
Well, before you go into the seventh bowl, I just had a thought. When the word says something as specific as it does here, great hailstones, about 100 pounds, mm-hmm. Can we assume maybe that's, you know how something, you might read something or hear something and you might say, wow, that hit me like a ton of bricks. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's all of a sudden the realization of what is happening and what you're experiencing really hits you deep and hard. Is that more what this is saying rather than something?
You're talking about in the seventh bowl when it talks about hailstones.
Yeah.
There. Yeah, I think that is a, like most of the numbers that we've encountered so far in Revelation, I think they're designed for some sort of impact, okay, you know, on us. Whether, you know, in some cases it's to make us aware that it's a specific number. It doesn't matter, like the 144,000 reminds us that God has an elect people. It is a specific people. It's not, you know, 144,000 people, and then that's it. And I think too, this is meant to, you know, your example of a ton of bricks is well taken. 100-pound hailstone is pretty much going to do you in, you know. And I don't even know that they're going to be hailstones, you know, literally, anyways. But it's meant to give us some, you know, estimation of the severity, because they, you know, they say they cursed. They curse God for the plague of the hail because the plague was so severe. Well, nobody survives getting hit with a 100-pound. So if you've been hit with a 100-pound hailstone, you're not going to curse God. You're going to need to be swept up, you know. And so, but I think it's more for you know, impact, as I said. So the sixth and seventh bowls, though, as I said, bring us really to the end, because now this world system we've seen over and over again is going to be judged. And we were already told that this was the case back in chapter 15, verse 1, as this all began in the introduction to the bowls. John writes, "Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last. For with them, the wrath of God is finished." So we've already been warned that this cycle of judgment is going to depict the very end. And so this picks up in verse 17, where the seventh angel, you know, pours out his bowl into the air. Let me read this. Did I read this when we started?
No.
Oh, I did read it. Okay, I didn't know if I read both the sixth and seventh bowls. So it begins at verse 17, and the angel has this statement as the bowl is poured out into the air, and it says, "It is done." Now, what does that immediately bring to mind? Christ saying, "It is finished." And, you know, I think that arguably the most glorious statement in all of the scriptures is Christ on the cross, his cross saying, it is finished. And because, you know, that phrase encapsulates every aspect of our hope. You know, of redemption. But the phrase that we see here in the seventh bowl is another matter altogether, because it does not represent redemption accomplished, but it represents the consummation of judgment. It's the horrific other side to that coin. It's in a sense, it's really one of the most painful. Unlike "it is finished," this "it is done" is one of the most painful utterances in Scripture, because it reminds us that the vast majority of fallen mankind one day is going to stand as the object of God's wrath. And that is a sobering thought. You know, while yes, God is glorified in this, it's not an occasion for cheering on our part. And I think it should give the church, you know, a heightened sense of gospel urgency. You know, when we read about this event and we realize that this is where human history is leading, is this great judgment. So, you know, these things were written, I think, to shock all who read and hear Revelation, believer and unbeliever alike. We ought to all be shocked by this statement, but for different reasons. So as verse 18 begins, we see lightnings, you know, sounds, thunders, and this great earthquake. And all of this is qualified by the phrase, "such as there had never been since man was on earth." And I think that the language here represents more than simply destruction and disaster. It certainly does that. But, you know, we first see language like this back in Exodus 19. I think that's the origin of this language, as God comes to his people in a theophany. On Mount Sinai, if you remember, we were told that there is thunder, lightning, smoke. And then in the rest of the Old Testament, and also in extra-biblical, you know, ancient Jewish writings, this same kind of language is used to represent judgment. But at the same time, we have to remember that that first usage on Mount Sinai, that what it ultimately represents is, yes, judgment, but it represents the coming of God. That's what it represented in chapter 19 of Exodus, was the coming of God to his people. And so in this judgment, we're also to understand this is the coming of God, just as it was in Mount Sinai. You know, God is ever present in the midst of judgment. In case it's not clear that this seventh bowl represents final judgment, I think we have some pretty good evidence that it is. We have this phrase at the end of verse 18 that's taken fairly directly from Daniel 12, where if you remember in Daniel 12, Daniel writes of the time of troubles at the end of the age. And Daniel even speaks of the general resurrection. Let me read two verses from Daniel 12. You don't have to turn there. It's the first and second verses of Daniel chapter 12. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such has never been since there was a nation till that time. You know, that same language that describes the earthquake. But at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So I think it'd be very difficult to argue that Daniel is not talking about the end of the age, the final end. And verse 19 goes on to elaborate on the effects of this great earthquake. The primary impact that this earthquake has is that the great city, which we find is Babylon the Great, another name for it, is finally destroyed along with the cities of the nations who have long been in alliance with this worldwide system of opposition to God and his people. We're told that God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. And we've already seen this image of the wine press of God and wine used as the product of this wine press. And now we're being told that the very last drop of that wine is reserved for Babylon the Great. Babylon the Great will drain that cup. We'll drink every last drop of it. God is not for a moment forgotten. You know, this phrase that, you know, God remembered is not to make us think that he wasn't thinking about it. And then all of a sudden, oh yeah, Babylon. That's not what it means. It means something quite different. It tells us, it's an expression that tells us that God had never for a moment forgotten what Babylon has done. As, you know, she was already determined, it was already determined back in verse 6 of this same chapter that Babylon would be repaid in kind for what she has done. If you remember that verse read, "For they have shed the blood of the saints and the prophets, and you have given them blood to drink. It is what they deserve." You know, God has not forgotten that this is what he intends to do. And we've already looked at, as I said, the imagery of you know, wine as the byproduct of this awful wine press of God's wrath. And in this case, Babylon, you know, is said to drain every bit of that cup. And this, again, I think reminds us that what we see here is final. There's no more left in the cup. In verse 20, we see what is really a second repetition of what is said three different times in Revelation. In verse 20, we read, "And every island fled away, and no mountains were to be found." If you remember back in the seventh seal, in chapter 6, verse 14, we read, "The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place." A very similar expression. And, you know, here in the seventh bowl, we read that every island fled away and no mountains were to be found. And then in chapter 20, verse 11, we have a connection of this to the actual great white throne of judgment. I'll read that for you. It says, "Then I saw a great white throne," something that we associate with final judgment, the great white throne, and him who was seated on it. "From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and there was no place found for them." So a little different, but similar idea in that. So I think we have this connection, though, with final judgment that we really can't disagree with. All of these phrases remind us of the universal nature of final judgment and even the cosmos. You know, whether it be the mountains and the seas, or the heavens and the skies, the stars, you know, even the cosmos will not escape or hide from this judgment. And in the last verse of chapter 16, you know, as Larry brought up earlier, we have the hail plague of Exodus is repeated. You know, it's the same plague that we read about in Exodus, but here it's repeated with 100-pound, you know, hailstones. And I think another aspect for why these hailstones may be pictured as being so big is to reinforce that this is not the same plague. This is not the judgment of a nation. This is a judgment that is universal. This is all of the nations, all of the peoples of Babylon the Great are now being judged by you know, this version of judgment. And I think there's also in this, we see a recognition by the people that this plague is from heaven, which again argues that this is probably not a literal plague of 100-pound hailstones, because the people survive it to the point that we understand that they recognize this plague is from God. We've seen that pattern before. And according to that same pattern, we see the glimpse into the hardness of their hearts, because we're told that the people cursed God rather than cry out to him for mercy, which we would think would be the logical, but that's only the logic of a regenerate heart that would say, well, certainly we would cry out for mercy. But, you know, again, these things are such powerful pictures of total depravity and the hardness of the human heart, that no matter what God does, even when God reveals himself as being in it, they curse him. And their reaction, as we saw from the beginning of Revelation, is to flee. You know, back in, I think it was chapter 6, we read that they fled to the caves and the mountains. And so there's this irony that picture of what they're clinging to in these times is what God is judging. Says the, you know, the islands have, there's no place to hide. Yes.
I've seen that happen many times in people who are unbelievers. When something bad happens, believers, they may question God. Mm-hmm. Why me? Things like that. But an unbeliever turns away.
Yeah.
And rejects God.
Yeah, this is not creating moments of doubt for people. This is not creating, you know, kind of dark times of the soul or anything like this. This is leading them to just cursing. They know exactly what's going on, and this is their reaction to it. So this is the end of chapter 16, and I guess I'll say a few things about 17. As we move into chapters 17 and 18. They're very related chapters. It's really, in my opinion, one continuous kind of episode. We take this phrase from chapter 16, "And God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath." You know, we take that one expression from the seventh bowl, and I believe we're actually expanding that into two chapters. You know, we read that, we say it's awful, but what does that look like? I think now we have two chapters that are going to give us a solid glimpse into what does that really mean. And so I do think that the chapter 17 and 18, with so much focus on Babylon the Great, ought to tell us something of the importance of what Babylon represents and the universal evil that is encapsulated in that image. You know, we complain about our government, our legal system. We complain about world events, the price of gas, you know, our education system, all these things that we complain about. And as believers, though, I think ultimately we don't even sometimes know what's really frustrating us. Yes, these things are frustrating, but I think the real source of frustration for us is that we live in Babylon the Great. And this is how it goes in Babylon the Great. I think that's the picture for us of Revelation. We were destined to be frustrated with where we live. I mean, look at it from the other side. What if things were so grand that we got along with everything and everybody and everything was good? There's something odd about that picture. You know, the scriptures, not just Revelation, remind us, you know, as we know from the New Testament, it's not flesh and blood that we wrestle against. It's not, you know, the local people on the Board of Education that we wrestle against. It's principalities and powers. It's something bigger, it's something darker, it's something more evil. And I'm not saying that we ought not get involved in these other things, because I think we ought to. But I think we need to keep our wits about us and realize that there is a bigger picture and that these things ultimately cannot be corrected, you know, as a whole, that they will be corrected when God himself corrects them. And unfortunately, it's with great judgment. So, you know, there's so much text dedicated to Babylon that you know, I think I can only conclude for myself that apparently God wants us to really know our enemy. I mean, he tells us an awful lot about Babylon, and I think he wants his church to know and understand who its real enemy is. You know, again, our problem is not with a president. It's not with a Supreme Court, you know, justice. They're small players in a larger kingdom. And as chapter 17 begins, we immediately see the continuity with the bold judgments. Because we see in the first verse of chapter 17, we're told that it's one of the very same angels that poured out the bowls that now, you know, says to John that he's going to show him a more detailed vision, a vision of the judgment of Babylon. So let me read. I'll just read the first six verses, and we'll stop there today. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abomination." There's the full name of the, you know, of Babylon the Great. We've seen several titles, but there's the most complete. Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of the earth's abominations. That pretty much encapsulates it. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. You can see all the connections with this prostitute, with all the things we've seen coming before, which I think, you know, reassures us that this is in fact Babylon the Great, who's being described as this prostitute. And John says, "When I saw her, I marveled greatly." All right, yeah, let's pick up with that next week. Any final comments? All right, let's close.